Miami City Ballet presents Program 2, Tradition and Innovation, featuring a world premiere by Liam Scarlett, Royal Ballet of London celebrated choreographer, plus the classic Don Quixote, Pas de Deux, and two George Balanchine audience favorites. Program 2 opens January 11th in Miami, January 18th in Fort Lauderdale, and January 25th in Palm Beach. Tickets at MiamiCityBallet.org or 877-929-7010.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, I won't tell you mine, but did you make any New Year's resolutions?
Well, I thought about it. I mean,
you resolved not to make resolutions.
Well, I don't really believe in making resolutions, just like our guest.
Well, it's January 10th. How many of your steadfast resolves are still in force? We have psychologist Jeremy Dean with us. He's the author of Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Changes Stick. Jeremy Dean is a researcher at University College London, and he joins us from, guess where, London.
Okay.
Good evening to you, sir.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Jeremy, tell us about the 21-day habit formation theory that you talk about.
Yeah, this is was the start of the book. I wrote a blog post simply asking how long does it take to form a habit, and I Googled it, as you know, that's where everyone gets their information from nowadays. So it said 21 days, and being a researcher, I thought, let's see, where does this number come from? Is there any research attached to it? And it turns out there wasn't, but there has been some research done at UCL, as it happens. And they got people to try to ingrain relatively regular habits, like eating an apple or drinking a glass of water, and some that were a bit more difficult, like doing some push-ups. And they found there was a massive variation in how long it took until the habit was totally automatic. Anything from 2-3 weeks, something like that, for a glass of water for one person. And then there was another guy in the study who was trying to do some sit-ups, and they still hadn't made it a habit after 2-3 months, something like that. When they projected it forward, they thought it might have taken him about 2/3 of a year before he had turned it into a habit. So you can see there's going to be massive variation between people.
So it depends on the habit, it depends upon the person, it depends on so many things that this 21-day thing that we've heard so much is just unfounded.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And I think in some ways it's dangerous if you hear this 21 days thing and you think, okay, now I'm going to start my habit or my New Year's resolution. And you think, okay, 3 weeks. And then when 3 weeks have passed and it's still not a habit, you think, well, there must be something wrong with me. Well, I'm here to tell you there's nothing wrong with you. You know, it does vary quite a lot.
Good news. So which do you think is most instrumental in making or breaking a habit? Willpower, discipline, or self-control? And how do they differ? I don't really know the differences between them.
Well, I think they're, you know, you're tapping into much of the same things there, I think, and we all vary on the amount of self-control we have, and that varies throughout the day. So, you know, it'll go up and down in the morning, perhaps your self-control is stronger, and then after a long day at work and with distractions and tiredness and so on, it goes down. So, yeah, there's a lot of variation over the day.
How about how our wants don't relate to specific situations, such as instead of saying I won't have any snacks, it's if I snack, I'll have grapes or an apple.
Yeah, this is so important, I suppose. And you were talking about not believing in New Year's resolutions, and that's kind of the thing that irritates me about New Year's resolutions, this idea that we're going to transform ourselves, and also the idea that, you know, New Year's resolutions tend to be quite vague, so people are saying, going to be healthier in the new year, or even more vague, I'm going to be a better person. What I say and talk about in the book quite a lot is this idea of making really specific connections between actions and situations, because that's what a habit is. It's a connection between a situation and an action that you perform in that situation, or it could be a thought. So what you can do is, as exactly as you're saying, you can link up, you know, if I feel hungry between meals, then I will eat an apple. And it's that. It's like a blueprint. That's what it is. It's a blueprint for that habit. that you're hoping to ingrain.
You talk about automaticity. What is that exactly, and how does that relate to making or breaking a habit?
Yeah, there's only one curve, there's only one graph in this book, and it's just this graph of automaticity increasing. Automaticity is just when you do something without realizing it. So it's part of the definition of a habit, really. It's like you go into the bathroom and, you know, you brush your teeth, hopefully, and you're, you know, when you're making a cup of coffee, you automatically put the kettle on and get the cup out of the cupboard, and all these things are sort of happening really without you having to think about them too much. And so each time you're, like when you're making a new habit, each time you repeat that action in that situation, you're increasing the automaticity. In other words, you have to think about it less and less.
So you mean that will lead to more success in actually making or breaking a habit?
Yeah, it will do, yeah, because each time you're repeating it, then it's going to become more automatic. So when you're making a habit, that, you know, you're climbing up that sort of curve towards full automaticity.
So what is it about making a habit, a healthy habit? Why is it so difficult?
It's partly to do with the fact that they live in the unconscious. Around about half of the things that we do every day, psychologists have found by asking people and studying what they do, are habits, which means that we're doing them automatically. And because they live in the unconscious, we're not necessarily aware of everything that we do and all the things that we're thinking. So when you come to try to make a change, you've got this problem that it's very difficult to change something that you're not conscious of. So one of the first steps with habit change is increasing that level of self-awareness.
We're speaking with psychologist Jeremy Dean. He's the author of Making Habits, Breaking Habits. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Also, you can get in by email if you're a little bit shy. That's radio@wlrn.org. Jeremy, what's the neurological basis for habits? There must be a beneficial evolution gain for humans to have them so ingrained in us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say the vast majority of our habits are good ones. Things like looking both ways before you cross the road and putting your seatbelt on. All these things are really good for us. And what they're doing, all these good habits, is they're keeping us alive and on time and healthy, hopefully, and allowing us to think about other things in our lives. Because, you know, the brain is an amazing thing, but it only has a limited amount of concentration that we can apply at any one time. So we need all these habits running to keep us kind of safe and to allow us to think about higher things, hopefully.
So let's take a bad habit like smoking. What do you suggest? What would be the first step that you would suggest? Are you in favor of non-smoking aids like Nicorette or the nicotine patch or any of those things? Or do you think it just is we just need to use behavior modification?
Well, I'm absolutely in favor of anything that the studies say works. So when you look at the studies on nicotine replacement therapy, they do show a small, reasonable increase in success rates. So yeah, absolutely use those. But by the same token, also the studies show that these kind of behavior modification techniques can work really well as on top of that. So, and it's so difficult to quit smoking. It's one of the most difficult habits to quit. So you've got to use absolutely everything, I think. You've got to throw everything in. I don't think you should be one of these people going, okay, I'm just going to quit on Tuesday and I'm not going to use anything. I'm just going to use willpower because it's not going to work.
So when you say use behavior modifications, what kind do you mean? I mean, specifically.
Well, one of the things that you can do, which applies to all habits, is to look at the situations in which you perform that habit. So when is it that you're smoking? And what you're looking to do with all habits, including smoking, is you're looking to replace a bad habit with a good one. So with smoking, quite often people choose something like chewing gum. And if the gum has the nicotine replacement in it, then that's great. So then you're kind of feeding two habits at the same time. You're feeding the chemical and the behavioral habit. So it's always about this replacement that you're looking for. So that's one technique you can use.
Okay. And another?
And another. If you think about a sort of higher level technique then, so this was quite a specific one related to situations.
Right.
But you've also got motivation on top of that as well. So one thing you can do is visualization. So it's about thinking about the positive aspects of when you've given up smoking and the negative aspects of smoking, which, frankly, we're absolutely surrounded by, aren't we? The negative. So that should be relatively easy. But I don't know. Still, people manage to avoid these things. We're bombarded by messages telling us how bad smoking is for us, and yet people persist with it and manage to block them out. So I suppose it's about accepting those negative images and trying to make those as strong in your mind as you can, and that should help boost your motivation.
We're speaking with psychologist Jeremy Dean. He's joining us from London. He's the author of Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Changes Stick. Jeremy, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And we return to Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we rejoin with psychologist Jeremy Dean, who's joining us from London. He's a researcher at University College London. And his book is Making Habits, Breaking Habits. Jeremy, tell me more about the SciBlog website that you created and what people can find there.
Yeah, I started that blog 2004, and it wasn't much to start off with. But like any habit, you have to work on it over time. And the writing habit seems to be the same. It seems to take much longer to develop a habit of writing than anything else I've tried. So, I write on there about psychology studies and try to translate them into English, really. That's the main thing. And I'm looking for ones that are really relevant to everyday life, I suppose. And that's one of the things that started me off on this book, was writing about habits and just seeing how big the response was and how many people were interested in it. One of the things I really like about habits as well is they just cut across so much of our everyday life. You know, if you think that half of it's habits, then, there's all kinds of things where it cuts into.
Well, as a researcher and expert, Jeremy, let me get a little personal with you. Is there a bad habit that you've tried to break that you couldn't?
Well, I can tell you about one that I succeeded with. It was while I was writing the book, I thought, I should try and ingrain a new habit of my own, one that I've struggled with over the years, which is flossing.
And flossing?
Flossing. I've always found it very difficult to floss.
Oh, okay.
Dental flossing. Okay.
Yes.
Shame on you.
I know. That's what my dentist always said to me. So, but
they all
I finally managed to sort it out now, so I'm pleased with that.
And so you do it every... So you do it every day now?
Every day, without exception.
Once a day or twice a day?
Twice a day now.
Okay. Let me ask you, do you think that we're all capable of breaking a bad habit or developing a good habit, or are some of us just not cut out for it? We just don't have the discipline or the willpower or the self-control or whichever, or all those things?
I think we definitely vary quite a lot in how much self-control we have. And there's probably a genetic component to habits as well. If you look at things like obsessive compulsive disorder, which is, the habitual component of that is really high. And there's definitely a genetic component in that, if one member of your family has it, then you're more likely to have it. So I think there's probably a large amount of variation, but it will depend, on the techniques that you use as well. So I don't think it's a hopeless case for even those of us who have quite low self-control. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to get at in the book, is that the self-control is perhaps, let's not worry too much about that. Let's see if we can make plans that will sort of get around our self-control.
Okay, so if it is, I mean, do you believe there are addictive personalities? Is that what they're called? And
yeah, there probably, I suppose there probably are. Yes, if I guess there are. You do seem to get that thing. Things like alcoholism also has a genetic component as well. So I'd imagine that some people do have that kind of propensity to develop these sorts of disorders.
And for them, it might be more difficult to break a bad habit and replace it with a good habit.
Some people just do seem to find it hard. You know, that study that I'm talking about, you know, that was done two, three years ago at UCL, exactly that is coming out of it. You're seeing, they had about 100 people in that study, and some people were trying to ingrain the same habit, and, you know, it took some people a lot longer than others, so there will be a lot of variation, yeah.
Again, we're speaking with Jeremy Dean. He's written Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Changes Stick. There must be somebody out there who wants to ask Jeremy Dean a question about breaking a habit or making a good one. And if so, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN.
And also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Jeremy, what about when you try a new good habit, but somehow revert to old behavior? How can you avoid that?
Yeah, this is one of the irritating things about especially bad habits. And we talked a bit before about how good habits stay with you. Well, in just the same way, bad habits stay with you. And even once you've learnt a new response to a particular situation, those bad habits still stay there in the background. And for example, with alcoholism, alcoholics have to be continually vigilant. They have to make sure that you know, they're not getting themselves into the wrong situations again, because that habit is there waiting to be activated. So, it is a problem to try and keep these things at bay. But one of the things you can do is this kind of, it's all learning the alternate response is what you're trying to do, and trying to train yourself to at least turn a bad habit into a neutral one, and hopefully a good one.
But what about if your spouse has a habit that annoys you, but they seem to enjoy it? How can you?
Oh dear! Danger! That's what I would say.
Now you're talking about breaking other people's habits.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, it's so difficult to change your own habits. How can you change other people's? Well, I would say go carefully, very carefully,
and don't nag.
Nagging, doesn't tend to work too well, does it?
No.
And you don't need a psychologist to tell you that. But one of the things you can do is it's kind of an awareness thing, I think. And I don't know if you guys have had this experience, but certainly I've been told, oh, you have this habit of doing, you know, like wiggling your leg or touching your face or something like that, which I didn't even perhaps know I had. So that's that first step, is to sort of make your spouse aware that this is a habit, perhaps try to avoid being too pejorative about it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you say is not to be too hard on yourself if you do revert to a bad habit, go back to a bad habit. What are the dangers of being too hard on yourself?
Yeah, well, there's just some recent research coming out that self-compassion is good for you. You know, we tend to get this message quite a lot, that you've got to push yourself, and you've got to, you know, you've got to be really tough with yourself, and you've got to torture yourself to get yourself to do all the things that you want. But one of the problems with being really tough with yourself is that it's just easy to lose motivation. You just think, well, I can't do it. Let's not bother with it. So there's a few studies coming out now to show that it's okay to just say, that's all right, I forgive myself for that slip-up, and we'll try again next time. And the problem is with habits is, as we're saying, they will keep coming back to bite you. So you're much better off to adopt a more sort of forgiving and mindful attitude to them. That'll work better in the long run, I think.
Okay.
And we'll take a quick call. This is Emery in Miami. Hello, Emery. Hi.
Hi. I've been listening to the discussion so far, very interesting, especially for me. I consider myself someone of a quote-unquote addictive personality. But I was wondering, do these addictions go beyond physical habits? Because I find that a lot of times I have friends, or even myself, that can develop what I consider to be almost addictions emotionally to other people. I have a friend who's going through a divorce currently, and it seems that some of the hardest things are stopping, not calling anymore when you need someone. And do you find that it's sort of the same thing, those physical addictions and sort of these emotional needs?
Yeah, I think we talk a lot about physical behaviors with habits, but something we haven't talked about too much is the habits of mind, I suppose, and the habits of emotions. And that's one of the things I talk about in the book, this chapter on kind of how thoughts can go around in your mind and how they connected to emotions. So, yeah, absolutely, that's a really important component of habits. And it can be just as sort of damaging, although you don't tend to see it because, it's all hidden away in the mind, isn't it?
So many people just watch over and over again like dumb TV shows instead of doing something constructive. It's just their
habit. Yeah, and that can be such a dangerous habit. Absolutely.
Thanks for your call, Emery.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Go ahead, Doctor.
Oh, okay. We have an email. Which is more this is a listener in Plantation. Which is more difficult to break, a mental habit or a physical habit, or are all habits classified as mental? It's common for the women in my family to think negatively or less about themselves. How can I break a habit that seems to have persisted for generations?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And there are techniques, though, in that are used for depression that involve thinking about trying to challenge some of these automatic thoughts we have, sort of some of the classic automatic thoughts that people have, habitual thoughts, like, I am worthless, or, I'm not as good as other people. And it's about trying to kind of contrast reality with some of these habitual thoughts. So it's about trying to get out of the habit of thinking about yourself in those ways. But these, as the emailer was saying, these things can take a long time to change. So, it's certainly not an easy undertaking.
Do you believe that we should reward ourselves if we're successful in making or breaking a habit?
I'm a bit down on rewards as a method for kind of motivating yourself, because generally speaking, and psychologists have done these studies over decades actually, that intrinsic motivation, in other words, wanting to do something for its own sake, for an internal reason rather than for an external reason, tends to be stronger. And the other thing is about rewards is we tend to get used to them. The first time you reward yourself with something, you say, okay, I'm going to do this. You get some pleasure from it, but then after a while it tends to reduce. So much better to find intrinsic reasons why the activity is worthwhile, why it's important to you. And now I think you're more likely to stick to it.
So the Pavlovian method is no.
Well, yeah, it can be dangerous. Yeah, it does work. But I think we are a little bit more complicated than dogs and pigeons and rats and things.
Well, maybe we aren't.
Well, there's certainly an element that where we act. I mean, if you see people tapping away at their mobile phones, then we do look a little bit pigeon-like, then, I suppose.
Well, it's been an interesting half hour with you. We've been speaking with psychologist Jeremy Dean. He's the author of Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Changes Stick. Jeremy Dean is a researcher at University College London. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Food and Dining is next. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Food and Dining Thursday has arrived, finally. Joining us now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. And Linda, we're eating very healthy today with South Florida-grown organic produce and more. I have a freshly plucked carrot here.
It's beautiful. Aren't they beautiful? The colors. Mm. They're all different colors.
And
carrots,
the smells.
Mm-hmm. Mm, they're wonderful. Well, Joe, get this. How about a big, frothy sweet strawberry milkshake.
Ooh.
Made with...
I'm in.
Can you just taste it? Mm-hmm. Made with just, you know, locally grown...
I won't say with a cheeseburger, though.
No. Well, okay. It's that time of year again when the farmers are bringing their produce to market. Freshly picked strawberries. I love those big red bell peppers, mm-hmm. and the real tomatoes. Well, sometimes we forget that the farms are just a few miles away from our city centers here. And buying local is a treat, especially in today's green economy. Our guest today is here to tell us about our local farms, her dinners in paradise. Doesn't that sound good?
Yes.
And how we can create our own patch of organic garden. And she's Gabriella Moreski, and she's the owner of Paradise Farms Organic. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We're delighted that you're with us because she's filled the studio with all these wonderful things.
I just pulled out a scallion here.
All right. Just leave it there. You're not supposed to eat it yet.
Keep going.
We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions from our farm expert? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576 or email us at radio@wlrn.org.
You got it.
Sorry, Bonnie. Took that away from you.
No. That's great.
Okay. And also, joining us, as he does every week, is our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker, and he's joining us by Skype. And you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what's in your glass today?
You know, Joe, I'll bet if you look hard enough, you could find an organic hamburger or even cheeseburger with some organic gravy on it.
Yeah, I wouldn't
but
trust.
If it's organic food, I'm obviously going to talk about organic wine.
All right, I wouldn't trust the two of you together. Okay, now, Gabriella Moreski, Paradise Farms. It's a wonderful name. Where is it, and what do you grow?
We are located down in the Redland, in the agricultural area south of Miami, between Miami and the Keys. And we specialize in baby greens, edible flowers. We have 52 different varieties of edible flowers that we do throughout the year. We do oyster mushrooms. And we also do the dinner in paradise that you mentioned. And we've added brunch in paradise, which is a wonderful
wow.
family event.
We'll get to that in a minute because you just mentioned these oyster mushrooms. And these are gorgeous. I know we don't see these in the market. I'm looking at them here. And they're huge, big, white.
Very light, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful, with lovely. Tell us about these.
Well, oyster mushrooms are very nutritious. They're actually 15 to 25% protein. And
15
to 25% protein.
Mushroom?
Yep, put that in your smoothie.
Yes. That is amazing. Now, are all oyster mushrooms that way, or is it because of the way you grow it?
All oyster mushrooms, yeah. And there's different varieties. There's pink ones, there's yellow ones, there's brown ones, there's white ones, but they're all oysters.
Linda Bonnie wants to taste one.
Yes,
she wants one. Well, I was hoarding them here. and tell us some other the things that you have here.
Well, I also brought with me one of our salad mixes. This is we call it the baby brassica blend. And we now sell it to the chefs. They just love it. It's also available at some of the farmers markets. And this is brassica greens. So it's arugula, mizuna, mustard, kale, extremely nutritious. And
really
then we
pretty.
Top it with our edible flowers for color.
The flowers are beautiful. I wanted
and they
to
taste
tell
good, too.
These are beautiful. Were these nasturtiums?
Yes, those are the nasturtium flowers.
Oh, wow. And rose petals?
Yes. Uh-huh. And if you eat flowers, just make sure they're organic.
Right, because otherwise they'll have something, excuse me, on them.
Preservatives or something.
Right, yes, and those are beautiful. And you have also these little tiny microgreens.
This is some shiso, and it looks some basil microgreens.
Now, what is shiso?
It's in the mint family. And
it's a type of mint.
It's, yeah.
Let me taste it.
And the beautiful thing is about the two-leaf stage, when it's the microgreen stage, it has all the flavor of a mature plant. So,
I just tasted the chiso, and it's so wonderful. It's the flavor. Sometimes you have Chinese food or something, you say, what is that flavor? And it's really it's very distinctive. It's hard to explain it.
Yeah, we'll pass it along.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm eating it. And
Linda.
Well, and then you have these. These have these wonderful little baby eggplants. They're sort of long and narrow.
Yeah, these are called Louisiana long. Uh-huh. And also a snowy eggplant. So these are a long, narrow eggplant.
Well, does that mean they don't have the seeds in them? Yes. Okay, so she's looking at me. She doesn't
those
know.
Are
she
eggplant?
Just goes, those are eggplants. They're beautiful. They're like, how would you describe their shape?
I don't think I want to go there.
All right, that's what it looks like. Okay,
it's called
good.
Long.
That was very graphic, Joe.
All right, so let's... let's carry on because we have a caller here, and Ellie, is it Ellie in Miami? Is that how you pronounce your name?
It's Ellie Brecker.
Oh, hello,
hello
Ellie.
Ellie Brecker.
Hi, Ellie.
And I don't want to talk about dogs.
or obituaries.
Right, exactly.
Explain. We better explain who Ellie Brecker is. She's the columnist for the Miami Herald.
Of course.
Yes, okay. You have a question.
I do. I have two questions. I am trying so hard to grow organic heirloom tomatoes and organic red peppers and organic everything. And two things are happening. A plague of whiteflies.
Exactly.
For which I have tried all the organic remedies, the spraying, the detergent and the oils and the whatnot. And they scoff at me and continue to eat my peppers. And then hand-to-hand combat with squirrels over my tomatoes.
I hope your hands don't get in the way of the squirrels.
So,
all right, let's have Gabriella. Maybe she can help you because whitefly has been destroying a lot of the vegetation
horrible.
Here this year. It's really been big.
Well, I have to say, knock on wood, that we don't have a whitefly problem on the farm. And part of it is that we have a balance. When you have a lot of different products, you don't have a monoculture, so you're not creating an environment for one species. I think the most important thing is that when you're applying your organic products, the insects are always on the undersides of the leaves.
Uh-huh.
So it's important when you put the soap on it or whatever you're using to spray it on the bottom of the leaves, on the undersides where they're actually habitating. Because sometimes we have a tendency to spray the tops.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't really work that way. And what you need to do is, maybe grow something that is not, that doesn't, the whiteflies don't like as a
what would that be?
Carrots, fennel. So maybe interplant some dill in there with it and some fennel in with it because they don't like that. And that could help break up the population. And I know it's a frustrating thing, and sometimes I think as farmers we just plant a lot of things and we hope that we get a certain percentage of what we put out there.
Yes.
Well, now, some people, for example, planting marigolds next to it, would that help?
Yep.
I know
marigolds
a lot of-
are for insects. I don't know specifically on whitefly. But you can look on the internet under companion planting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole list of plants that you can plant to ward off another species.
Any kind of homemade pepper spray or something that you
there's
can
a cayenne, there's a hot pepper, hot yeah. sauce spray you can do. And that's more for animals. So if you want to keep uh-huh. them, maybe the squirrels from eating your peppers,
the tomatoes,
you can spray it with the hot pepper on it.
Oh, okay.
Well, good luck, right. Ellie.
Just make sure you all wash right. it before you eat it.
Yeah. All right. Thank
good luck.
You.
Keep growing. Keep it growing. Now, you've got some other food here that is just looks so wonderful. I've been eating all of it. And that's tell us about this.
So we have dehydrated products that Tom Frazier makes these at our farm, and he sells it at the farmer's market in Coral Gables. And I have in front of me, this is his kale chip. He calls it cheddar, but it's not really cheddar, but it looks like cheddar. And he uses cashew and red peppers, and it gives it this wonderful crispy. Yes.
And it's very good because I tasted it.
It's crunchy. I wanted you to get that crunchy.
It is crunchy.
What do you do? Dry it in the oven?
In a dehydrator. And all the
All
the snacks that he makes are gluten-free, sugar-free, low glycemic index, trans fat-free, and delicious.
And you've got some of these bars over here with lots of nuts and seeds in them that he makes. And this is at the Coral Gables Farmers Markets, which is on Saturday.
Yes, that's
on
correct.
On Saturdays. And tell us, what are some of the other farmers markets?
Well, the farmers markets that carry our products, mm-hmm. We work with Urban Oasis, and they actually have three markets. And they're in North Dade and at the Unitarian Church in South Miami and also in Liberty City. And also farmer Margie from Bee Heaven Farms. She's at the Pinecrest Market on Sundays.
All right. So lots of and they were all organic. Did you have a question?
And we have a question from Frank, an emailer. Getting good results with soil formula in book The Square Foot Garden. 1/3 topsoil, 1/3 vermiculite, 1/3 peat moss.
Great formula.
Okay.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah.
What, does that help growing or with the insects?
That helps with growing. And what I find, there's something called paramagnetism. And what that is that when a plant is under stress, it'll attract insects and diseases. And really, it all depends on having a healthy plant. And a healthy plant starts with healthy soil. So if you have a good soil, then you're good to go.
That's wonderful. Now, dinner's in paradise. We're going to break in a minute, but tell us, when is your next dinner in paradise? And
we're
going to
have
that
in February 9th, and we're doing it in conjunction with Slow Foods, and we're calling it Slow Love. And the proceeds from that dinner go to them. And we'll have music, and we have Chef Rodolfo from Toro Toro is going to be our featured chef for that dinner. It's on usually our dinners are on a Sunday. This one's on a Saturday night, and we'll have dancing.
Oh,
wow!
And a bonfire,
and that's down in the farms, and it's just a beautiful setting. You can go to your website and see photographs of them. What is the website?
www.paradisefarms.net.
Right,
and we have
What's
a quick
the
email.
Price of the dinner.
Fred wants to know the price of the dinner.
It's $165.50, and that is a 5-course meal with fine wines.
Mm.
You would love the wines, Fred.
So come on down from Michigan, Fred.
Sounds good to me.
Right. Okay, well, we're talking with Gabriella Mareski. She's the owner of Paradise Farm Organic. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Gabriella Mareski. She's the owner of Paradise Farms Organic, and she's been talking about our local farms, our farmers markets. She's been giving us some advice about organic growing, and she's also enticing us with her dinners in paradise. But dinner in minutes time, and here's a dinner in your paradise home that you can make in just minutes, and it's based on using our local ingredients. Mediterranean snapper with Greek salad. Now, sweet. Yeah, have you eaten yours already?
Mm, yes.
Along with the carrots and the flowers.
Hot, and I just ate my first flower ever.
You've been eating everything, both of you. All right. So, fresh snapper needs very little cooking—about 8 minutes under a broiler for this recipe—and it's topped with some tangy pimentos and some capers. And while the fish is cooking, you can make a simple Greek-style salad and use our local lettuce, because I notice here, Gabriella, you have this beautiful red lettuce here and all of these wonderful things, some tomatoes, some cucumbers, and you just you just get a dressing, or you can make your own dressing and put it all together. So you broil the fish for about 5 minutes. And here's my tip, which is what I wanted to tell you. If you're going to put your fish under the broiler on a baking tray, put the baking tray under the broiler while it's heating up, so it'll get heat on the bottom. So when you put the fish on the top, it'll get heat from the tray and heat from the top.
Oh, I never thought of that.
And there you go.
It makes such simple sense.
Right, and then you don't have to turn over your fish and have it break up and all of that. So it's really, really easy. Then you want to put a little feta cheese and maybe some navy beans into the salad to make a complete meal.
Yeah.
So that whole recipe and a photo is on my website, dinnerinminutes.com. And by the way, all of my recipes fit the government nutritional guidelines. So follow me on Twitter. It's L. Gassenheimer. And did you enjoy it? Yes?
Oh, yeah. Well,
your mouth is full of mushrooms. Is your mouth full of a mushroom or what?
Flowers.
Oh, you're eating the flowers.
I'm eating the flowers.
Are you sharing?
I'm kind of hogging them.
Yeah.
Well, there's like a taste of arugula to them.
Yeah. And what's interesting, also, we have a borage flower, and that tastes like cucumber. And so different flowers have different flavors.
They are so delicious. I feel like a flower child.
Well, let's go to... She is a flower child. Let's go to Fred Tesca. Fred, what are we drinking? It sounds like we're drinking here, I know.
Yeah, it does. It does. Actually, the perfect wine for an organic dinner would be an organic wine, or at least a wine that's as close to organic as possible, because there are some difficulties. There are three levels of this. First, you have organic grapes, and these are grapes that are grown without chemical fertilizers or herbicides or pesticides. But while the grapes might be organic, most winemakers still add some sulfites to the wine, so the wines themselves are technically not organic. And the problem is that sulfites are preservatives, and if you don't add them, the wines tend to oxidize very quickly and lose their color and fruity qualities. So there are actually a few truly organic wines, and you'll see them displayed separately in separate cases in supermarkets. But a lot of people say that you should keep them under refrigeration even before they're opened if you buy them this way. The very top level is grapes that are what is called biodynamic. And here the grower treats not just the vines, but the entire vineyard and its surrounding environment. They bring in beneficial insects to fight the harmful ones. They build birdhouses to attract owls to eat the mice. They make herbal teas to treat the soil, and they even do their pruning by the phases of the moon. And some of this sounds kind of flaky until you think about it. If you prune under a full moon, its gravity pulls the sap high up in the shoot and is lost when you cut it. So if you prune under a new moon, you save that sap and you make the vine stronger. So there's a logical basis for it. Now, the problem is that biodynamic growing is labor-intensive and expensive. Benziger Winery makes a wonderful biodynamic tribute red wine blend. It's a wonderful wine, but it's $80 a bottle. So what's happening now is a lot of California growers are taking a different tack. They're turning to what they call sustainable growing. This means they minimize chemical products as much as they can, but they keep the option of using them if, as an alien her whiteflies, if they encounter a pest they can't fight by organic means. So sustainable growing also takes into account the need to make a profit, and it also includes concern for such broader issues as runoff into nearby trout streams, fair treatment of pickers, and that sort of thing. So it's a very broad concept. Now, the problem with this is that very few wineries label their wines as sustainable. So if you are concerned about this, though, there's a website you can go to get a list of all the wineries that do sustainable growing, and that is sustainablewinegrowing.org. So you can check that out.
Well, that sounds very, very interesting. Let's go back to Gabriella. Gabriella, CSA, what is that? Community Supported Agriculture.
Right. And that started actually in Japan, and it's a direct relationship between the consumer and the farmer. So the consumer buys a share at the beginning of the season, and that gives money to the farmer up at the beginning of the season when the farmer has to buy fertilizer and seed. And then they get a box or bag of produce every single week for the length of the share. So we have a couple of CSAs down here. Bee Heaven Farm, if you go to Redland Organics.
By down here, you mean in the Miami-Dade area.
Yeah.
Are there any up in Broward or Palm Beach area?
Not that I know of.
That you can Google CSA.
Yes.
And it'll give you the list of where they all are, actually.
And I think the thing to look at to see which ones are actually supported by real farmers versus organic product being shipped in.
Right.
To look at that.
Okay. And so what are the ones here in Miami-Dade?
Margie, as she has Bee Heaven Farm.
Margie.
Pekarsky.
Right.
And her website is redlandorganics.com.
Mm-hmm. So you can Google that.
Yeah, you can Google that. And then Tina's Pride is not organic, but they also they specialize in heirloom tomatoes.
Right. Now, I know Tina hasn't opened some Sundays where you can go into the farm.
One Sunday out of the month.
Right. And does Margie have an opening or not?
She has hers in the fall every year. Twice a year she has an open house.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go to their websites and check their calendars.
Or you can go to the farmers' markets and buy their products.
Do we have time for a quick email, Linda?
I think very quick because we're almost out of time.
Renee wants to know what the farm does to ensure their crops won't be subject to cross-contamination by conventionally treated farms.
It's a quick answer because we only have a few seconds.
Here. Well, we have barriers around our farm to protect from other farms, and the most important thing is to only use organic products and only buy from organic farms. Keep it consistent.
There's no
cross-contamination.
Well, we'd love to keep on talking with you, but we're out of time. It's been a wonderful week. Gabriella Mareski, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And for this very exquisite taste of your special produce from Paradise Farms, I feel honored to have it. You can reach Gabriella Mareski at info@paradisefarms.net. Or just Google Paradise Farms Organic. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
And Joseph Cooper, And Bonnie.
Indeed, this has been fun.
Yes. You both ate well today. Next week, we'll be talking with Food Network star Melissa Darabian. She'll tell us how to look and feel younger. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Mm-hmm. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like so your friends can find us as well. We also have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. Follow the radio link. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, Bonnie and I return with a discussion of social networking and the dangers to privacy and even your job or marriage. And the calendar on this day in 1939, 74 years ago, the birth of actor Sal Mineo in the Bronx. He was stabbed to death at age 37, apparently by a pizza delivery man. Exodus, Rebel Without a Cause, the Gene Krupa story. And also in 1945, 68 years ago, the birth of Rod Stewart in London. He was a member of the Jeff Beck Group and Faces as well. One more while we ponder blacklisting and HUAC. On this day in 1961, 52 years ago, the death of mystery writer Dashiell Hammett in New York at age 66. He created Sam Spade of the Maltese Falcon, Nick and Nora Childs, and of course the brainy pooch, Esta, in The Thin Man. Hammett worked for Pinkerton at age 13. So we leave with a thought from Dashiell Hammett, whose novel A Simple Art of Murder was greatly admired by the great Raymond Chandler. Quote, I've been as bad an influence on American literature as anyone I can think of. This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Next, it's the Talk of the Nation.